It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to the special 109th episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a special treat for you all. First up will be my interview with Dean Haspiel, one of the creators of The Fox from Red Circle Archie Comics. We talk about how the book came to be and about the character and a lot of good things. And it's a hot book right now, selling out all over the place, so I'm sure you're going to want to listen to what he has to say. Then I have a great interview with Dennis Culver, one of the creators on Edison Rex from MonkeyBrainComics.com. We also chat about how the book came to be and about some of the things that I didn't know, some great little Easter eggs for fans in the book. There's a special anniversary issue coming out soon, and we discuss that and what this milestone means to the creators. Both The Fox number 2 and Edison Rex number 12 will be up Wednesday, December 4. So be sure to hit your stores or Comixology to make sure that you get your copies. We have a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. I want to welcome to the podcast today Dean Haspiel, one of the creators of The Fox, coming out from Red Circle Comics, part of Archie. How are you doing today, Dean?
Very good. How are you?
Good, good. It's good to talk with you because I really like The Fox. I have to say it's not what I expected.
Which is, I don't think it's what anybody would have expected, even though, well, actually, I don't think anybody's expecting a Fox comic in the first place. So it was kind of wide open in that respect. But anybody who is familiar with The Fox, or even, you know, Alex Toth's short iteration of The Fox, I think they were probably imagining more of a, crime, pulp, you know, maybe even like a detective type story. And we snuck that a little bit into the first issue and then kind of went off the rails by page 18.
Yeah. One of the things I really like about it, of course, is that the Fox is way out of his league. I mean, he doesn't have any powers, really.
That's what attracted me to the character, was the fact that it's a superhero without superpowers. And then I added another twist, well, a couple of twists. One was, basically wants to quit being the Fox. He kind of started something that he doesn't want to really finish. But in the spirit of that, he has become a sort of freak magnet, where he's attracting all kinds of trouble, because of his job, because of his costume, and maybe because of his hesitation, frankly.
Well, I enjoy it because, you know, I guess I expected Batman more than I expected what we're getting, and that's good. I like to be surprised, so I was really thrilled with it when I got to start to read it. And I said, this is just something amazing. I mean, how did you come up with this take on the Fox? I mean, where did it come from?
Well, honestly, I was, I've always been a fan of this character, even though I've only seen, the Alex Toth version and a couple other iterations. But there was something about the costume, and there was something, again, that attracted me to the idea of a superhero without superpowers, and I kind of filed that in the back of my head. And in a way, he's kind of like, very classic and pulp kind of fiction in that way. A lot of those characters that were created in the 1940s, a lot of them didn't have superpowers. They had Olympic strength, they had agility, they had, great minds, and very few had superpowers. In fact, I was talking to Mark Waid, because, he's such a historian regarding superheroes. And I asked him, besides Superman, who kind of had every power, what was the first specific power for a hero? And he said it was the Flash. And I thought that was really interesting because, you also kind of, it's a sign of the times type thing. So I guess back then, a guy that could run really fast was a cool idea. And then of course there was the guy who could break walls and fly and heat have heat vision and see through things and all that stuff. But by large and small, it was a lot of characters didn't have those kinds of powers. They still told mystery and crime stories. So I think I was attracted to that. I've read a bunch of Mickey Spillane stories. I really dug Frank Miller's Sin City, that kind of stuff. And when I revisited this character and talked to the editor at Red Circle about trying to do something with him, I decided to flip the script on myself and do the exact opposite of what you would think a Fox story would be. But I was kind of hip-checking the idea of telling some kind of epic pulp story. And, I dusted off or kind of my own inklings of, who is John Carter, Warlord of Mars, who is Doc Savage, The Shadow, Green Hornet, Flash Gordon, Ming the Merciless, and all those classic 1930s and 40s characters. And I kind of did iterations of that in this particular story that you're reading, the Freak Magnet story, which culminates in issue 5 for this first arc. And I do kind of wink at those types of characters through the Red Circle universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's pretty good because, I agree. I was very surprised when I started to read it because I couldn't figure out how in the world he's going to get, through this stuff. How's he going to resolve these things? Because he's just an average guy.
That's part of the fun and the trick of the Fox is, not only put him into all kinds of scenarios and, in a way, he's almost like Buster Keaton, and how is he going to, hop from one train to the other and flip through a window and get out of stuff. And that's the fun of it. And also, you get to relate as a person that you could possibly don the costume and become the Fox in that way,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, it was just it's about hijinks and yet making something that's not only fun but, dramatic. I mean, you do kind of wince at times and wonder how he's going to get through this, and he uses his own kind of internal monologue, this humor that he uses as a way to deal with the fear. And that was something that Mark Waid added to the mix, was that kind of interior monologue. He's like own reportage of this kind of stuff, So, I'm glad you're digging it. I'm really glad.
Now, Mr. Waid, of course, is helping you with dialogue on the book, as I understand it.
Yes. Yeah. He I don't think, I mean, sure, I've written comics before, and I knew this was going to be a great undertaking. I didn't have a voice for the Fox. I had his agendas and motives and, a story to tell, but I didn't really have his voice in my head. And I love the way Mark Waid writes. I'm really enjoying Daredevil. Obviously, I've enjoyed a lot of his comics, and I knew he'd be the right guy to be able to, write his voice. And later on, after he wrote the first issue, he told me he was thinking about James Garner from the Rockford Files, which I thought was perfect.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah, Mr. Waid does have a way with stories and dialogue and good things like that, so that's pretty good. Yeah. Now, you guys have had tremendous success with the first issue. I understand it sold out.
The first issue sold out. I was really, blown away by that. In fact, the day I did the signing at Jim Hanlon's Universe, we found out that day it was officially sold out and they were going to a second printing. So we're hoping to sell out the second printing and go to third printing. And then obviously you want that to cascade over to, the next issues 2 through 5. Fingers crossed that will happen. I mean, it's a slow burn in some ways because, gee, here's another superhero comic you have to get, in the stands, compete with the Marvel and DC legacies. But I feel like we're doing a really good job of bringing something classic yet a little different to the mix.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was well reviewed. I mean, I was looking across the internet at people who review comics. Whenever people talked about the Fox that I saw, it was always very positive and very strong, supporting it. Major spoilers, I wanted to write a review of it, but the head of the site, he grabbed it first and they did a little podcast about it. And so we had to fight over it, and I was like, oh no. So I actually talked about it during one of my previous podcasts.
And thanks again for doing that. I mean, every little bit, helps. I mean, the more people hear about it, the more it will hopefully pique their interest in wanting to at least grab a copy and check out what's happening here.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask you something, because when I was reading the book, I was struck by the similarities between the Fox and Spider-Man.
Sure.
You know, his alter ego was a photographer, and all these different things that seemed to, you know, a lot of things about him reminded me of Peter Parker, and I thought it was so interesting to me because the Fox predates Peter Parker.
Well, you know, yeah, and so you might want to, you know, reverse engineer that question and say, hey, Spider-Man has a lot of similarities to the Fox. You know, I think, again, when you look at some of those older characters, those pulp heroes in the 40s, a lot of them were reporters or detectives or, you know, that's what kind of got them out into the fray and, you know, experience adventure. It also, I think, spoke to their own mindset that they were looking for trouble or looking for the story, as it were. You know, and nowadays, I think it's harder to be a reporter. Sure, there's reportage that happens, but it's with different gadgets and different ways of dispensing the news. You know, in our first issue, Paul Patton is a reporter for a newspaper, but as we know, newspapers are dying. Print is dying, unfortunately. On one respect, on the other hand, I hear that comic books are, you know, pretty healthy in the print format. And you know, with our independent comics, that's mostly where they live. So you know, it's a little bit of a dance between digital and print. But of course, that's another conversation. But regarding the Fox, you know, we're going to play and talk about that idea of things that, you know, become archaic. And in fact, if you know, in the first issue, in the backup feature, Paul's looking for an actual camera that does take print pictures to give to his son, because his son has been kind of uploading and dumping all kinds of digital pictures from his digital camera on the internet, that he wants them to respect the power of a single image and how to excavate the narrative gold from that, which, you know, he then employs in the story in order to get out of the situation. You know, he's not an old fuddy-duddy, but he respects the older ways of how we did things. And that's something that also interests me. I think it interests Mark. But meanwhile, of course, me and Mark Waid are also, you know, some of the progenitors of webcomics. You know, his site, ThrillBent.com, you know, publishes original webcomics and digital comics. I launched Activate, a webcomics hub in 2006 with a bunch of folks, and then recently Trip City. And but concurrently, I'm also doing a print edition imprint called Hang Dye Editions with two of my studio mates, Seth Kushner and Gregory Benton. So, you know, there's a lot of flip-flopping that happens, but really you're just trying to find you know, use the virtues of the tools we have today. And I think that's also going to be in the story when we revisit after this arc, if there is a second story, which, fingers crossed, the sales will dictate that.
Oh, it looks pretty good right now, I tell you. Because it's a sales. Like, I was so happy when I heard it had sold out. I was actually kind of hoping that Stan Lee would come out and say, well, yes, I did draw inspiration from the Fox or something. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen. I think he probably drew more inspiration from Shakespeare, the way he wrote. I just love Stan Lee's dialogue.
Now, you did bring up a subject that we can just touch on briefly. That's I think is important. The business of digital comics.
Yes.
What's your view of the future? Since you're invested in digital comics, you are probably one of the people on the forefront.
Sure.
What do you think is going to happen as far as print versus digital in the next 10 years?
Well, what I thought about, and I'll say, you know, the pamphlet is still surviving. What I thought is the pamphlet would go the way of the dinosaur, the pamphlet being, you know, the 22, 24-page, you know, weekly/monthly comic book series. But I think, you know, we still have diehard fans that likes the tradition, as do I, of going to the comic shop on a Wednesday, perusing the racks, seeing what came out, you know, flipping through the pages. Sure, there's a different version of that online that you can do. But I think ultimately what will happen, and this is a prediction I made years ago, is that print will become like expensive poems or art objects. Or, you know, kind of like, you know, when you get a DVD and it has all the DVD extras, that kind of stuff. I feel like print will become $50 to $100 items. And pamphlets will slowly but surely transition to digital, you know, iPad, you know, performance type items. And then ultimately what will happen is that those 4 to 6 issue arcs will be collected in print, for your bookshelf if you so desire, until maybe eventually, and probably in my lifetime, there won't be as much print happening. You know, we are making this huge transition. It's scary because it means you're relying on electricity, you're relying on the big matrix, the big cloud in the sky to be your library. But, I mean, I'm talking to you, and I'm in my living room right now, and I see nothing but boxes and shelves and, you know, and in the ceiling. My walls are covered with all these things, and I think, you know, and not that I'm a collector, maybe I am, not a collector proper, but I do hold on and covet the things that I love, but, there's something kind of serene and meditative about a blank space. And I think people, especially people who live in big cities with small apartments like I do, you know, it's starting to, you know, topple all over us. And there is something smart and keen about, you know, transitioning to a digital phase or a digital way of holding on to things. I mean, my greatest fear, though, is that in that transition, you'll just have a big empty living room with like one big black monolith that holds on to everything and has everything inside it, kind of like the monolith in Stanley Kubrick's 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Just that thing standing. And and the thing that makes us cool and fun and unique is when you do go into someone's home and you can see the bindings and the titles and the DVDs and the CDs or the records or the books, and you get a sense of that person's personality and who they are, and those things spark discussions. And that's a beautiful thing. I don't know if a big black, you know, monolith that you have to, like, you know, search inside of can yield the same kind of parlay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting to me. I was talking to somebody who deals in comics, and they had a child, a young girl, and she was so used to the electronics, when they put a book in front of her, she was taking her fingers and sliding them across the book trying to get the page turned.
I've seen examples of that. And at first it's jarring and scary to folks like us. But then again, I will get a text on my phone saying, "Hey, is it okay if I can call you?" I'm like, "Are you kidding me? You could have just called. I could not pick up, or I will most often pick up." But there's this like two-stage way of people trying to contact each other, and I find it to be odd. And when I ask people, "Why do you do that?" they say, "Oh, I don't want to interrupt you, but you just did with the little thing that, you know, hit my phone, and I did read the text, you know, and then I'm writing you back to say yes, or I'm calling you back. I don't understand what's happened." I remember when I was young, there was this thing called a telephone, and it rang, and you didn't know who was calling, and you either picked up or you didn't. And then later on, you were able to have an answering machine for the calls you did miss when you weren't at home. And then the phones started to tell you who was calling. And now we have this, where the phone really is actually, it's a camera. It's a global positioning device. It's a social networking system. It's almost like the phone part. What we're doing right now, talking, is secondary to what the device has become.
Well, I've gone to restaurants and watched everybody's texting to each other, and I'm going like, why don't they have conversations? You know,
what happened to the conversation? And I posit that, you know, the social networking supposedly has connected us even more, but I think it's disconnected us. It makes us think that we're talking to each other. We're just talking at each other.
Yeah. You know, it's not a real conversation, because people see something, and if they respond, it's kind of a slow thing. And this all impacts comics, because, you know, I see people – I was actually showing somebody a digital comic on my iPad, and the person remarked about how great the colors were.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you backlight those colors, you know, I don't care how beautifully, you know, something can be done in print – something about backlighting, the type of colors that occur in comic books is magical, actually. But on the flip side, you know, a really good designer will know how to utilize print and make something that feels like print and is print. And I feel like that is also one of the things that is happening. I'm going to have a book collection, a Billy Dogma book collection. Billy Dogma is a character I created in 1995, and I've kind of, you know, done short stories and long form stories. And in fact, that was one of the comics I did at Activate when I decided to do web comics. But a publisher, Z2 Publishing, is going to be coming out with a book called Fear of My Deer, which is a Billy Bogner story. And that's going to be coming out at Mocha in April of 2014, next year. But I couldn't have done this book without the book designer, Eric Stillman. And Eric Stillman is I believe, an Eisner Award-winning book designer. He's the guy that does the Criterion collection covers and those books and those DVDs. And he's an amazing thinker, and he really understands print. And there are many, many designers out there. Chip Kidd, tons of folks. A lot of the guys who work at Fantagraphics and Drawn and Quarterly, they understand print, and they make it worth your while. I understand that, you know, comics traditionally, you know, the pamphlet is kind of a disposable item, something you roll up and put in your back pocket. And then, of course, that turned into you buy a comic book and they try to sell you a Mylar bag with a backing board. Because maybe you'll use tweezers to turn the pages and then, you know, elegantly slip it back into its, chamber so you can resell it or something. I like a good beat-up comic book. It means it was read.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. I mean, you know, it's like with the Fox, what you're doing there is telling a story. And what's the good of – I mean, you could just – a lot of people get comics and they never even bother to open the cover up to see if there's anything in there. It could be blank pages as far as they know in that comic.
Exactly.
But see, what you're doing with the Fox, though, is a lot of fun. Your art style really is so attractive. And it reminds me very much of, say, Bruce Timm's work in, like, Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, I wish. I wish I had that kind of talent.
Oh, it looks like it reminds me of it very strongly. And I that's one of the things that makes it very it has a dynamic feel to it when you draw it like that.
Oh, well,
and
I do think about that. I mean, listen, I'm a huge fan of Jack Kirby, one of my biggest influences. I love Will Eisner. I love Alex Toth, of course. I'm a huge fan of C.C. Beck. C.C. Beck, who, you know, co-created Captain Marvel, a.k.a. Shazam. And I really love the playfulness of his artwork and his style, where he, you know, he basically put in what you needed to see and not anything more. I'm a big champion of that. You know, I don't know how to draw a million lines to arrive. Well, maybe I do draw a million lines, and then I erase them a lot. And then when I finally find the right lines, I reduce them. And I get down to the core, the image core of every character and background and prop. And, you know, that can be considered, and, you know, probably is a cartoony style. That's what I'm attracted to. Those are the types of comics. And I'm also attracted to those kinds of Silver Age stories where you pack a lot into a few pages. I know when manga became popular, you know, Japanese comics, and they kind of, like, told a story, like, you know, you could get 30 pages of just an introduction of a character walking to a room. It kind of slowed down the pace. And I respect that type of comic book storytelling as well. But then that, you know, kind of got adopted by, American mainstream comics, Marvel and DC comics, where arguably, a six-issue arc is what would have been a one-issue story back in the 80s or 70s or even the 60s, you know? And again, I like that when it's done well. Sometimes it feels like padding. But, you know, I was trying to get a lot into the first issue, and I feel like every issue that happens after in the Fox, I pack a lot in there. I make sure you get conflict, story, you get to learn about the person. I hope you care. I mean, if you don't care about these people, it's not going to work anyway. So hopefully one of the tricks or the things that I'm concerned about is that you care about these people's plights.
Speaking of that, you did something very interesting with the Fox. You made him the original Fox's son, and the Fox now is married.
Yeah.
You know, there's other companies, let's say, that we won't mention who, don't care for married couples. And so you're doing something that kind of bucks the trend of the bigger companies.
Well, the idea of him being the son and married was not my idea. When I decided to do this character, I got hip to where they were taking this character, or wanted to take the character. And I did think it was interesting he was married. And, you know, with that recent, you know, idea, and it was from DC Comics, I believe, basically said, you know, married superheroes are boring. Or they're just not that interesting, or that they don't want to, you know, tell those stories. I totally disagree. I think, gosh, you know, how many married friends do we have? And all it is conflict half the time, you know? I mean, I feel like you can get a lot out of a married couple story and then go ahead and make them both superheroes. Are you crazy? Like, imagine the kind of stuff that could happen. And that's, if we get to do a second story, which fingers crossed will happen, that's one of my plans, is to discuss and kind of, like, show what happens when two superheroes are married to each other and what that yields. I think that there's tons of stories to tell.
So we've never seen that, you know?
I don't think we have. I mean, I scratch my head, and I don't think it's wholly original, but it's definitely not the trend.
Yeah, I can't remember a married couple superheroes, except maybe like in Astro City or something like that, where you've got so many people who are heroes. But overall, you know, it's usually like it's Superman and Lois Lane.
Right.
But I guess now they've got Superman and Wonder Woman, so that would – this is kind of – instead of being married, though, they're just kind of dating at this point.
And you know what? At that, and when it comes to Superman and Wonder Woman, those are just gods. Like they're beyond superheroes in a certain way. Like what I love about superheroes is, you know, they're extraordinary, but I love their limitations and the things that make them weak. And, you know, I don't know if I could write a Superman story or a Wonder Woman story because they're so, so invulnerable, and it's hard to find their vulnerability unless they're trying to be human. Then you can, you know, maybe have a story there. But, yeah, that would be really tough. I love when you know, as ridiculous, absurd as it seems for Green Lantern that the color yellow is what defeats him, at least, you know, he has that, and people can mess with that, you know. I don't know. I love and you know, with the Fox, he's just a guy. You know, he knows a little parkour and kung fu, and, you know, he's smart, and he can think 12 ways out of a situation when he's not distracted. But, you know, I there's something about, you know, putting up blockades and how you get through them as a person to the point where it's not even superheroic. It's just human.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the riveting part of it to me. I got to know how in the world he's going to get out of this. You know, you go a lot more supernatural in the second issue, which was great fun to read.
Oh, thanks.
But there's also something else that's interesting in the second issue is you get a backup.
Yes.
You've got Mr. DeMatteis doing the shield in the back.
Yes.
Was that something you guys originally thought of, or did that kind of come?
That was part of my plan. I knew it was going to be a monthly book, 5 issues, and honestly, well, it's twofold the answer. I had never done a monthly book. Or if I did, it was like 10 years ago, and I had a lot of leeway time. I've done a few graphic novels where I produced 10 pages every 3 weeks, but I never had the crunch time of doing an actual, like, monthly book to see what that feels like. And boy, howdy, is that difficult. I don't know how these guys do it. I don't know how Jack Kirby did it, but he was, talk about a god, he was another, you know, he was inhuman. So I wanted to test my will and my skill and try to do a monthly book. So that was one of the reasons why I took the challenge here. And I've definitely learned certain shortcuts. I've learned what I can and cannot do, so on and so forth. But with that in mind, because we have to produce a 24-page comic book, I wanted to reduce my ability to 18 pages. And then I thought, well, let's do a 6-page backup feature. So I talked to the editor about that. We arrived at which character we wanted to use the shield. And then when I pitched the idea, the full concept of the 5 issues, and I don't want to give too much away, but the shield is very integral to what happens in the Fox story, even though the backup takes place during World War II. And that's all I'll say about that.
Well, I noticed on your website that you have the cover for issue number 5 up there.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of shows, I don't give it too much, except that it's out there in the public, so I guess...
Oh, it's out there in the public, so you see that there's the Fox and the Shield. Well, I guess the cover does spill the beans a little bit, but that's okay because the solicitation is out. But let's just say, without, you know, talking too much about the story, is that the backup feature meets the lead story in the 5th issue.
That'll be fun. Kind of a climax towards everything to Big Pitch.
Yeah, and when we were thinking about the Shield, I mean, I grew up reading Captain America, and one of my favorite Captain America story runs was written by James DeMatteis. And he and I have talked in the past about trying to work with each other. And you know, so I asked if he would write The Shield, and he had done an original miniseries with one of my studio mates, Mike Cavallaro, and the story of the series was The Life and Times of Saber 28, which was kind of a Patriot superhero, along the lines of a Shield and a Captain America, but in their own way, in their own version. So I thought they'd be perfect to do The Shield, and boy, they knocked it out of the ballpark. And I'm really, you know, it's really exciting for me to, like, walk down the hall and see what Mike is working on regarding our comic, and then he comes and checks out what I'm doing. And it kind of feels like, you know, kind of that bullpen mentality of the old, like, Marvel days, where you're kind of just trading and looking at each other's pages. And then, you know, having to kind of, like, match certain story elements, you know, visually and that kind of stuff. So it's really great. And then we got Terry Austin to ink it, you know, the classic inker Terry Austin, who's doing a great job. And I got to say, I know you saw the second issue where the colors start to get somewhat psychedelic, I would say. And that was also a part of my pitch, is I really want not only for this to be pulpy and get kind of, you know, a little bit insane, but I want it to be psychedelic. And there's no way I could have ever done this without the colorist Alan Passalacqua, who is just bringing his A-plus game to this comic book.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty cool. You know, one of the things that interests me, too, is that, you know, people are bringing back these heroes from, like, the 40s through the 70s.
Right.
And a lot of them seem to be doing really well, including the Fox, I think, has to be included in that, because it started off with a big bang, and I just... You know, as I see, like, Captain Midnight coming back, and
right.
and the Owl, which I read when back in the 60s, say how old I am, and then
the Owl, I didn't even know that character. There's a where's he coming out from?
Was in the back in the 60s when Adam West's Batman hit the television. Anybody who had any property that in any way resembled Batman came out.
Sure,
and that's what the Owl was. The Owl had Owl Girl, and he had an Owl plane.
Who published this?
Oh, this was, I think it was Dell.
Dell, okay. I was thinking Charlton maybe, but I don't remember Charlton ever having an Owl character.
No, but I think Dell did it. And I love that, and all of a sudden it just stopped. I mean, when the Batman, you know, Adam West thing kind of just exploded and disappeared, like, in the third season, and then all these comics that I loved were stopped. And I was like, wait a minute, where'd they go? So, see, I see the Fox, and I think... It says to me that these heroes have life in them, and just because they kind of sputtered out at one time doesn't mean that they can't find new life today. And like what you're doing with the Fox, to me, it just shows that you can come up with new concepts for heroes.
Oh, absolutely. But they're not even that new, to be honest. I mean, I'm just taking what I see, and then I'm writing and drawing the things I want to read and see, you know, and honestly, you know, there's a lot of bleak superhero comics happening these days. It's been kind of a trend for the last decade where, you know, our heroes die or they rape each other or all kinds of awful things. And believe me, I'm a big horror movie fan. I don't necessarily need horror, though, in my superhero comics. So with that in mind, I was like, let me try to produce a comic and, you know, and convince Red Circle that we need comics like this again. I'm not doing anything brand new. I'm just trying to do the comics that I like, just kind of like what you were saying about Digging the Owl. I'm just bringing back the types of stories that I want to read and see, because there's not a lot of that going on these days. And so luckily, Red Circle is behind me on that, and hopefully there will be a fan base for it. I mean, I could be totally wrong. It could ultimately tank, and people are like, no, I want my superheroes to rape and kill, and I'll be like, okay, fine, see you later. You know, like, there's only so much I can do. But hopefully I'm making somewhat of a case with this 5-issue miniseries of the type of comics that I think, you know, there's room for on the newsstand. I'm not being, you know, prude. I like a good horror story. And sometimes that can be a superhero story, you know, with horror, of course. But I feel like there's too much of that holds sway today. And I'm trying to, you know, change that somewhat.
Well, I'm a huge believer in variety.
Yeah.
If all I do is read Long Johns all the time, and I believe me, I love my Long Johns.
Right.
But I like ones that aren't exactly in that same unending month-to-month thing, you know, storytelling that, you know, Batman is there and you got to leave it so that somebody else can pick it up. I like stories that actually come to a conclusion once in a while, or at least come to a place. And it looks like that's what you're going to do with, like, issue number 5.
Definitely conclude to tell the whole story. And then Red Circle has other things they're going to have coming out, which I don't want to spill. You know, again, it's a slow burn. They're trickling out these different comics and different heroes. And again, if people dig what we do with the Fox, I've already got tons of notes for a second arc and beyond. And you know, they are meant to be read in chunks. You don't need to have some, you know, continuity. Sure, could we produce a monthly book? You know, if I was able to hand off every few issues, like an issue or an arc to another writer, artist, or something like that, sure, that'd be a lot of fun. But you know, we're not gonna force it on you. You know, it has to make sense. And again, you know, I think that's what people dig. They like to go get a story arc. In a way, it's like reverse engineering a graphic novel. So you decide what the whole story is going to be, and then you put it out in five or six issues, and then maybe you take a little break, you know, and you keep them wanting more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think these days I'd rather have quality than quantity.
Exactly.
You know, people are so busy putting out monthly comics that they kind of lose. You know, after a while, you can see the quality dip, and then creators leave, and then the next bunch isn't quite the same. And before long, you've had like five creators down, and it's nothing like it started out that made it a success.
Well, what I don't get, and again, I don't own a franchise necessarily, and I'm not you know a CEO of a company, but so you know, we have Marvel and DC, and I'll just use examples. And they're like, okay, we have X-Men, we have, you know, Spider-Man, we have, you know, all these comics. Let's make four X-Men and, you know, three Avengers and, you know, monthly comics. And I'm like, why? Why can't you just tell one good Avengers comic, one good Spider-Man comic? I think in the early 60s when Marvel first came out, of course, they were just, you know, coming out with their comics. But I think at their height, they did like 11 different comics a month. Not their height, you know, in terms of, you know, today, obviously, I think it's like 50 to 100 comics a month or something. But, like, that to me makes sense. You have these characters, you're telling their stories. Once in a while, they cross over. You know, kind of like how they're doing with the movies. They did a Captain America, a Thor, you know, and all these different, and Iron Man. And then they had the Avengers movie. And now they're going back to the individual stories again. And then they'll have an Avengers 2. And then maybe Fantastic Four will come out. And, you know, Spider-Man and everything else. And to me, I can cope with that. It's harder for me to cope with, let's tell, like, a lot of X-Men stories and a lot of Avengers stories. That's why I kind of just walk away and I give up. I just want to, I don't have the mental capacity to hold on to all those stories. Plus, there's television and movies and books and everything else that they're competing with. So I don't really understand that. And that's why I really do like what Red Circle is doing, is saying, here's a story arc. You dig it, you like it, you want more, let us know. Oh, here's another character we have. Let's do that. And maybe we'll put out, you know, another team book. I mean, to me, that's, if suddenly there was 100 Red Circle comics coming out a month, I wouldn't know what to do, and I'd probably walk away, you know? sorry, Red Circle, but that's how I feel. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have to say that the comics, like X-Men, for example, you have to spend thousands of dollars and have read decades worth of stuff to understand all the continuity going on.
Right.
And I a long time ago, I gave up on that business. I don't read the X-Men anymore.
I read X-Men like Chris Claremont, John Byrne, Terry Austin, and you know, then Paul Smith, and then John Romita Jr., obviously the Dave Cockrums. I read a bunch of those, like a good chunk, a good 10 years or more. And then, you know, I think I went to college and I had to like pick and choose what I was going to read, and like maybe abandon X-Men for a little while. And then when I came back to X-Men, I couldn't recognize any. I didn't know what was happening here. Mm-hmm. You know, suddenly the bald guy in the wheelchair is walking. I'm like, what? And then he's not walking. And then there's other people taking over. And then there's other schools, and it's expanding. And again, I'm not stupid. You know, I can understand it, but I think the comprehension level of just like how do you keep all the continuity together just like threw me off. And I think it is because there's too many X-Men stories. I'm sorry to be bashing X-Men, because it's actually well done. You know, when it's done well, it's great. I think Brian Michael Bendis is really doing interesting stuff these days with it. But, you know, when it's too much, I can't cope with that.
Well, one last thing I want to say about the Foxes to me is, well, as I was reading the comic, it came to me that this would make a great animated series.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Because especially with your art style as it is, and it just felt to me like, man, this could be an animated show. And you know, you've got all the cable channels with animation and stuff on it, and a lot of times, like, they have Adult Swim and things like that. This could very easily fit into that. I mean, have you guys even considered some of that yet?
I haven't. It's a character owned by a company, you know, by Red Circle Archie, and if they think it's a good idea, I champion that idea. You know, would I be involved? Who knows? I don't have a lot of experience in animation. There are others who could do it much better, obviously, and are, you know, experts, but would I love to see it as an animation? Hell yeah. And, you know, would I like to contribute? Of course. So again, you know, maybe, you know, someone will be hearing this podcast and they'll think, hey, that's a good idea. Potentially that good idea.
Well, you can only hope. You know, that's why sometimes I ask questions hoping I get a, you know, just spark something to happen.
Yeah, you throw it out in the universe and then you'll see if it boomerangs back.
I know. They can send me a check anytime they want.
Yeah,
this idea. So what other projects have you got coming that we should be aware of, by the way?
Well, okay, I'm in the middle of finishing the fifth issue right now of The Box. Mm-hmm. And then I'm slated to draw a Batman 66 story come January. I don't know when that will be coming out. I assume sometime, you know, 2014. Mm-hmm. Then spring, April 2014, will be my Fear My Dear book, published by Z2. Which is a print edition of two stories, Immortal and Fear My Dear, featuring Billy Dogma. And that's My Own Little Baby. And recently, like I said, I launched an imprint called Hang Die Editions with Seth Kushner and Gregory Benton. My first publication is called Psychotronic Comics, which is basically a mixed bag of short stories that kind of mixes up memoir with Silver Age-inspired superhero stories and other things like that. And then I hope to publish something else under the Hang Die imprint, hopefully fall of next year. And gosh, I mean, I'm always writing and developing new ideas. I created this character called the Red Hook, which actually got me the Fox gig because it was semi-inspired by the Fox that I've written the plot for a graphic novel for. You know, I'm going to probably look a little bit into a Kickstarter situation. But fingers crossed there'll be a second Fox series, and I'll be working on that next year as well.
Boy, that'll be great, because people have not read The Fox, I highly recommend it. It's a great comic. You're going to get a very different kind of storytelling, and I like that in my reading. So I wish you a lot of success with The Fox. I just hope it keeps on going, you know, as long as possible.
Thanks so much, Wayne, and thanks for championing the book.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Welcome to the podcast, Dennis Culver, a co-creator of Edison Rex, which is available on Monkey Brain Comics, and it's having a big anniversary coming up. How are you doing today, Dennis?
Doing great, Wayne. Thanks for having me.
Good. It's good to talk with you. Edison Rex now is hitting issue number 12. It's 12 months in production. It's such a great book. What would you like people to know about the 12th issue that's coming out this week?
Well, it's the wrap-up of the second story arc, so it's kind of bringing everything together. That's gonna conclude for the second trade, and that trade will be out in the spring. So it's kind of bringing a lot of threads together through the whole series.
That's great. Now, who's publishing this?
That's going to be through IDW.
Oh, good. Okay, so that'll be good. And my understanding is this is going to be a trade rather than a hardcover.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, that'll be good. Why don't we talk a little bit about how you and Chris Robertson get together and make this comic happen? Because it's a lot of fun as well as a lot of adventure. There's both elements are real strong in it. Where did you guys come up with the idea for Edison Rex?
Well, we when Chris approached me at a comic convention about probably 2 years ago, maybe three, probably two, and he was talking about Monkey Brain. They were just kind of getting that together, and they were inviting creators. And we started talking through the weekend and decided we should work together. Mm-hmm. And he had an old pitch for Edison Rex that was something that he had originally pitched with someone else, and it kind of just was sitting in a drawer. And he asked, and basically that concept was, kind of what happened in the first issue, maybe, leading up to that first issue. Mm-hmm. And when he asked me what I wanted to do, I described essentially an idea that I had, which was Doc Savage kind of meets Lex Luthor, that kind of like from the perspective of a villain. And we both had these similar ideas, and we came together. So he sent the pitch to me. And what was more interesting to me was after what happened after that pitch ended, like mm-hmm. what happened next. And that's kind of where we started picking up the story and going from there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great, fun comic. And I want to point out, you can get it at monkeybraincomics.com, which will direct you to Comixology, so you can make sure you get it. I mean, what's it like to reach the 12th issue? I mean, do I work on it for a whole year?
It's exciting. It took us a little over a year to get it done, because it's just kind of working out the schedule and things like that. But us and Amelia Cole were both the first ones to reach our 12th issue, so that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to kind of be leading the way on that front.
That's great, because I love the book. I just think it's such a great thing. Your artwork really fits the whole storyline so well. You can do dialogue as well as action and the humorous bits as well too. So I really think you're doing a great job on the book.
Thank you.
And I think Chris does a good job too with the you guys working together. It all works, turns out really nicely. It's probably a better book with the two of you working together as you do than just one of you working on it.
Yeah. The way we come together for an issue is we'll kind of have epic email conversations that really we have emails stretching back from before we started the book that have things that we're still bringing to the book now. Mm-hmm. But from those emails, we kind of start pitching ideas back and forth to each other, and we kind of figure out what we want, what story we want to tell in that issue. And once we kind of, narrow that down, Chris will go and write an outline, and I'll take a look at it, and if I have any notes, we'll kind of hammer that out from there. And then from there, he'll go and write the script, and then I'll adapt that script into the actual book. So it may, a lot of times I'll add panels or take panels away because we don't have any limits on the book because it's digital. If I want to take one page and turn it into two pages, I can easily do that, and that's a kind of freedom that you don't have in print media. Is that you have that flexibility. So it's a unique experience, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, why don't you give folks the sort of TV guide version of what the book's about?
Sure. So Edison Rex is the greatest criminal mind of his world. And his nemesis, he pretty much is the guy who says, if it weren't for my nemesis, I would save the world. This guy's getting in the way. And, there's he's certain that there's something wrong with the guy. And so he does that. He gets rid of his nemesis, Valiant, and he gets him out of the picture, and he has to put his money where his mouth is. He has to do all of that he says, and now he has to save the world. And he decides to take that job on, but not everybody's on board with that, meaning the media, other heroes, and other villains. Nobody believes that Edison Rex is actually going to follow through on what he's saying.
Well, it's interesting because I, as a reader now, and I've got a chance to read the 12th issue that's out this week, which is great, by the way. I really liked it. I'm still sitting on the edge of my seat from issue to issue, wondering if he's going to stay a hero or if he's going to change. And, I noticed a lot, as you say, a lot of the characters in the comic also don't know what he's going to be doing next. And I always find that such a great thing about the book. That you keep us wondering what's going to happen next. And that's one of the things I enjoy the most about the comic.
He's, to me, the if Edison Rex just became a hero and everybody, and you know, it just easily happened and he got what he wanted, that would be kind of boring. It's more interesting to me, the struggle. And, you know, my theme for the book is actions have consequences. And he's done a lot of things that, you know, weren't nice, and he still has to account for those things. And just because he's decided that he's going to be a better person, that doesn't mean that everybody's just going to, you know, forgive and forget. And and so I like to keep that on the edge. Even before he had his villainous turn, if you look back in issue 7, you can see he was kind of an arrogant guy. And I think that's, you know, the biggest thing that gets in Edison Rex's way is Edison Rex.
Well, it's kind of funny because he is smart and sometimes too smart for his own good, I think. And but the great thing is you can watch him actually trying to change himself, and not everybody can change themselves that easily. And so he's finding it sometimes a little more difficult than he thought it would be, especially when other people don't believe in him and stuff like that. So it's such a great story to read. It's so different from what I read in other comics. I just think it's great.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Now, the Edison Rex, of course, is a big muscular guy, but he's got his group of people around him. Why don't you explain who they are so people know?
Well, kind of in the vein of Doc Savage, he has his group of assistants that help him out on missions. But it's an all-female staff. Behind the scenes, we call them Rex's Angels. But he's accompanied by his bodyguard, Malice, who she's a alien queen from another planet. And she kind of accompanies him everywhere he goes. And then there's Sarabella, who we meet in issue 3. And she was a former supervillain herself. She's a classic brain in the jar kind of character. And also someone he knew before he became a villain himself. They were both colleagues in the Gladstone Institute. And then there's another character that we introduced in issue 5 who's called Larva. And she's kind of a MODOK type character, where she's, you know, this genetically created worm creature. And she also has a bit of a crush on Edison Rex.
She's the one that kind of makes me uncomfortable occasionally. You know, she's this great big kind of worm-like creature with like horns and stuff sticking out in certain places. And she kind of wants to kiss Edison Rex occasionally. And it just kind of freaks me out a little bit when I read that. That's a good thing, I think, because I'm reacting to the stuff that you guys are doing. And I always thought she was such an amazing character. And going forward, now, in the 12th issue coming out, she actually takes a liking to somebody else too, but we won't say who at this point. But she is the one of the most interesting characters in there. And I just like the way that she's done. I like the fact that you've got all these different characters bouncing off of each other and doing well in his group. And I don't know what they're going to do next. I think that's one of the best things of it, is that we just have to keep reading to find out what's going to happen.
Excellent. Yeah, that's definitely our intent. Half the fun in Edison Rex is making up all these new characters and kind of populating our world and then seeing what they do with each other.
Now, one of the things I enjoy about the book is the humor that you have in there occasionally. Like, for example, you had Mall Santa, and Mall is spelled M-A-U-L instead of M-A-L-L.
Right.
Which I really like. And you have heroes and villains, and they'll have names that are kind of fun to deal with. Did you guys plan that at the beginning, or did it evolve naturally when you started working on the book?
A lot of it happened organically. As far as the humor, it wasn't it wasn't Chris and I's intent to do something like that. I think that's just kind of the natural byproduct of our collaboration. And, you know, I mean, we didn't really talk about it, but people started responding to it and saying it was funny. And we were like, yeah, I guess it is. And it's not something that we're trying to do, but it's just kind of a thing that happens. You know, our humor kind of shines through, which, you know, I think it's realistic. You know, like, not everything can be dire and dour. You know, there's definitely fun to it. And then as far as like some of the other stuff, I love a good pun. I'm probably responsible for a lot of the groaning puns that happen. But also, and then the hero names, I don't know if you're referring to that, but all of our heroes, all superheroes in the book are named after former comics publishers or current comics publishers. So,
oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so like Valiant is a comics publisher. Eclipse, you know.
Yeah, oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. Oh, man.
It even goes down to like Gladstone, Gladiator Gladstone. That's used Gladstone Publishing. It's a little Easter egg that we kind of put into the comics. So
if
you're paying attention, you can see that there's all kinds of things. When what that happened, that started out as a joke. In issue one, when you look at Rex's trophy room, there's a little glass container that has a bizarro version of Valiant. And I told Chris, wouldn't it be funny if we called that guy Defiant, because that was the company that Jim Shooter started after Valiant.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a joke, and we both laughed about it. And then we decided, you know, yeah, we should start naming all of our hero characters after publishing companies. Because of Valiant. So we kind of went from there. And it's a fun game to make those things kind of work. Mm-hmm. And if you know it's there, when you read through it, it's just a little extra reward that you can kind of see how we jump through hoops to make that work.
That's so cool. I never realized that. And I've read all 12 issues now. So, man, I think Edison Rex is the kind of book that the more you read it, the more you get out of it. And I think that's one of the great things about it.
Yeah, we definitely... we have a big overarching plan for the series, and we've been seeding a lot of those things from the very beginning. So it's my hope that if you reread the series, that you'll be rewarded for doing that. And that's my favorite kind of comics, is when I can read the comic on one level and enjoy the story, but then go back and read a bunch together and kind of see all of the seeds bearing fruit as you go. And it makes it you enjoy the book twice.
Well, that's one of the things that I really like about Edison Rex, and I've noticed that, especially like in the 12th issue, you've got some things that resolve while you're bridging on to other things. And so when I started to see some of the stuff in there, I had to go back and look and see, no, wait a second, this was foreshadowed in such and such an issue. And so I went back and looked. And I just think that's one of the great things of writing comics these days, especially, is that, you know, don't talk down to the reader. Talk, you know, tell us a good story and build on it, because once we like the book, we're likely to keep going. So I really like the way that you guys do that too.
Yeah, we definitely try to make each issue its own story, so that it's a self-contained thing that, you know, anybody could pick it up and read it and get a satisfactory experience from it. But when you put it all together, certain other pieces start falling into place. And I think that as we get deeper into the book, people are starting to realize that. And, you know, I like when I'm like, wait a minute, I got to go back and reread my books now, because it makes it, you know, just it enhances that experience. And it's something, you know, hopefully as we reveal more, you'll want to read it a third time and a fourth time to keep finding all the little clues that we've been dropping through the book. And we do it in every part, you know, even the Rex Files, every part, you know, there's always little Easter eggs that we're putting in there.
Why don't we talk about the Rex Files for a second, which, of course, I assume is a play on X-Files, which was a TV show.
Yeah, like I said, bad puns. That's definitely my realm.
Now, because pretty much every book, at the end, you have that. And I was wondering, do you do those kinds of explanations of the characters and the images of them so that you don't have to put more text or more dialogue in the story? Or is it just because you like doing that kind of thing at the end of the book?
Well, it kind of started out as, from a business standpoint, as a way to add more value to the book, to kind of, you know, put some extra bonus content in there so that, because you're buying a 99-cent comic, and it's not, you know, it's not a full 20 or 22-page comic. It's usually about 11 or 12 pages. So we wanted to add a little something extra. And it kind of started as a love for the old official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It's an obvious homage to that. And when I was a kid reading those, that was a way for me to experience the larger world without having to hunt down, you know, a bunch of Jack Kirby comics that I couldn't afford. So I could, you know, look through and learn about this world and learn things. And so it's in that same spirit that we want to hint at, you know, Edison Rex is just part of a larger comics world where there's other heroes and villains having adventures and capers and all of those things. And the other bonus part of that is that Chris made the choice to write all the X-Files Rex Files, I should say. You got me saying that now. but he made the choice to write it in Edison Rex's voice. And so what that does is not only does it reveal the other things that we don't really have the space or want to put on stage about that particular character, it also reveals more of Edison's character as the book goes on, too, because you know, I think his arrogance becomes very apparent in a lot of those Rex Files. You know, and he kind of dismisses everyone, and I think that's an important part of his character. Another neat thing, too, is it enhances our collaboration, because a lot of times when we're talking about the Rex Files, I'll give him just my general ideas, and then he'll go off and write something, and he'll add his own stuff to it. And then that'll spark ideas for me, and I'm like, oh, I like what you did there. Why don't, in a future issue, we have X happen? And so it's another way for us to collaborate where we're kind of, you know, filling in blanks, and then and that inspires each other, and we kind of make each other's ideas better as we go along.
Very cool, very cool. Now, before we get to the 12th issue in the future, let's talk a little bit about the art that you provide. I really like the art, the way that it has sort of a dynamic, almost an animated feel towards your art. And from issue to issue, I really enjoy it, that it kind of pops off the page to me, which I really like. And I swear this could be an animated TV show eventually.
No, that would be great. We wouldn't say no to that. Part of that is, a lot of it, I should say, has to do with Steve Downer's colors. He really brings a lot to the table. He does a thing I like where he keeps my figures flat, but he kind of adds almost painterly effect to the background. And I think that's what creates that kind of animated feel to it, where the characters are, you know, kind of like a little bit simpler, you know, kind of have a more cartoon feel, and then the backgrounds are a little lusher. And it makes the figures pop. Which, you know, I love his work. He always does such a great job. You know, he's a great part of the team for sure.
Well, I see that, but I also see that your art is like Bruce Timm-like in its design and the way that it goes. It kind of feels like it's you know, the simpler drawings, and yet you make such powerful use of the individual lines and things like that, that it adds a lot of character without adding a whole lot of stuff to them. Like Rex, for example, and the other ones, you have lines when they're needed, but you don't have all this other stuff that a lot of people do in there, or make it extremely dark so we can't tell what in the world's going on. So I like your art. It really fits the tone of the story that you and Chris are making.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. Bruce Timm, you know, is certainly an influence. Like, I love all of that Timm era DC Universe cartoons. The whole design aesthetic was great. You know, a lot of I look at a lot of Paul Ravachi's backgrounds as an inspiration. He did a lot of work on Batman Beyond and Batman the Animated Series. You know, and then Darwin Cook, of course, and people like that. And that's definitely an influence. And you know, clarity is really important to me. So I, you know, definitely try to keep everything kind of bold and big and clear.
Very cool. Well, I like it, and I think it really fits the thing so well. Now, let's talk about the 12th issue, which comes out this Wednesday. Is that there's a lot of fun going on and a lot of things that you're setting up as well as other things that you're resolving. But I have to talk about the cover, which is great fun. It's instead of being a Marvel cover, it says Monkey Brain, but you're following some of the Marvel tones of this kind of thing, and I really like that. When I first looked at it, I smiled because there's Rex's picture in the middle, and you have a whole bunch of the characters that we've seen before in the comic previously, and you have Monkey Brain above the M that says the cost on it. I thought that was such a great thing to make this a special issue.
Yeah, we did an homage to the Marvel 25th anniversary covers that they did in the 80s. And basically it was where they made a frame for every issue where all of the Marvel characters would be around the frame, and then the centerpiece would have whatever issue they were doing. For ours, since it's a book about a supervillain trying to grow straight, it's framed by all the supervillains that have appeared in the issue so far.
Oh.
And so it's all villains there. And including Edison Rex, who's, you know, he's still a former supervillain. And then, you know, there was just a lot of good coincidences. You know, Monkey Brain being an M name, we got to keep certain elements from the cover. And then using the Eclipse head, like the black and white Spider-Man head, it was kind of you know, a nice little touch there, too. I'm really happy with that cover. It's one of my favorites. You know, Steve did a good job coloring it. And then also, Somebody who doesn't get enough credit is John Hill, who's our letterer on the book. He helped with a lot of the, you know, making the Monkey Brain logo look kind of like the old Marvel logo and things like that. So he, you know, it was a team effort. We brought it all together.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the things that happen inside the book are just as much fun as the cover. You've got Edison Rex kind of working with Teen Peace as they used to be, and they've kind of melded into different, you know, the groups have sort of reorganized now that Valiant's not there. And I found it interesting that, well, Rex is trying so badly to become a hero and be seen as a hero that he doesn't understand everything that's happening around him, which is kind of interesting for a genius as he is.
Yeah, so I think that you know, intelligence can be, you can overcompensate for having great intelligence. And I think that sometimes Rex overlooks some obvious things because he's not maybe using his common sense. He's thinking of bigger things. And this issue, the members, the former members of Teen Peace, because they're grown up now, they're fighting a threat, and Rex tries to help them, and they don't want his help at first, and he has to overcome that. And eventually, you know, he's able to team up with them, and we kind of go from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not as everything is the way it appears to be, which is what I love. You know, as we get towards the end of the book, some secrets are revealed and things are kind of interesting. And there's so much that makes me wonder what's going to happen next in the future. So, God, such a great book. Issue 12 that's out this Wednesday. If you have any interest in this book, I would say be sure to get number 12. And I would say get the ones previous to it because it's just a great storyline all the way through.
Yeah, it's 99 cents an issue. So for less than $12, you can get the whole run right now.
Yeah, it's a super. Now, of course, now we're at the 12th, and this is kind of a landmark. What do you have in mind for the future? Have you started working on the next issue or the next arc?
Yeah. We've already planned out the entire third volume. Like we know exactly what's going to happen. Right now I'm working on issue 13, and then Chris is currently outlining 14. We've already had the discussion on that, and so I'm sure he'll, as soon as I get the outline and we look that over, then he'll start writing that. But yeah, 13 will come out in January, and then we'll just, for the next 6 months, we'll do that, and we'll wrap up that arc. 13, we're going to learn the origin of Malice, where she came from, and how her and Rex met. So it's another flashback issue, which is kind of like what we did in issue 7.
Right. I like that a lot. So I like it when you space it so we don't know if it's going to be exactly the same thing from month to month. So that's always a good thing. I think too many comics are just in the same old, you know, here's the supervillain of the month, let's beat the tar out of them, and then we go back to everything as being normal again. What you guys are doing are varying the storytelling, and you're adding to our understanding of what's going on by flashbacks as well as the Rex Files. So I like that. I like the feeling that this is an established universe, and it's going to be revealed to us as we need to understand what's going on with it. I like that a lot.
Yeah. We kind of have a big timeline. We have our own internal... I would say time doesn't work kind of the same way in the Rex universe as it works in our universe. But it's we have our own kind of golden age and silver age and modern age, and we pick and choose stories from that to reveal different facets of the overall story that we want to tell.
Are some of these heroes and villains characters that you or Chris developed in the future, like you were kids or something, or as you go along, you just come up with an idea and can kind of write it down and keep track of it?
Edison Rex was an old pitch that Chris had, so there's some of that. But also, some of it's less about the characters themselves and maybe some of the designs. Mm-hmm. I did a blog with Scott Kowalczyk where we would do something called Supervillain Showdown, and we would take pick a supervillain for the week or every couple of weeks, and we would redesign him, and we would each redesign our version of it. And one of the weeks it was Dr. Cyber, and that's where I first did the design for Cerebella. And so when Chris and I were talking about, you know, a brain-in-the-jar kind of assistant, he was originally saying a man, and I was like, well, I have this design right here, and it's pretty good. And he was like, oh, yeah, that's awesome, you know. And then a lot of times he'll go through my old blogs and sketches and stuff, And he's like, I like the design of that character. And then we talk about it and we kind of incorporate those things in there. But yeah, I'm definitely not afraid to reuse different characters. There's a character, he's appeared only in like one panel. His name is Don Cthulhu. And it was in issue 6. He's the Cthulhu guy that was turning everybody into windmills. Mm-hmm. And he was just, like I said, I like bad puns. So I drew him just as an illustration that I put on my blog. And mm-hmm. when that issue, it called for some, what Chris likes to call ghost busting, just showing mm-hmm. the team in action. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to just kind of throw him in there as a background character. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'll definitely, you know, crib any of my old ideas whenever I can, for sure.
Don Cthulhu. That makes me laugh. Yeah. That's funny. That is funny. So, you're going to have the origin of Malice. Are there any other hints that you can give us as to what's going to happen 13 going forward?
Well, it's basically like my theme for the book is always actions have consequences. So it's kind of everything coming to a head. All mm-hmm. of the things that you've seen in the last few issues are kind of we're tightening the screws on Edison Rex, I guess you could say. And so he's going to have to definitely account for everything he's done. And, you know, there's things that hints we've been dropping about various characters, and all of those are going to pay off in one way or another. But also, I think by the time you get to the end of the third volume, you're going to be really surprised.
Ooh, I love a good surprise.
Yeah.
I love a good surprise. Okay, now Edison Rex is coming along, and what other projects do you have in the works that we should keep our eyes out for?
I have a Dark Horse Presents story that I'm currently illustrating that I also wrote. It's called Davy Jones and the Mystery of the Monocle Men, and it's a three-part story that'll be come out serialized through Dark Horse Presents, I think in March, maybe. And then I've got a graphic novel that is in production at Oni that I did the art on. It was one of my first comics works. The coloring just finished on that, and I think that'll probably be out at some point next year. And then I've got another book that I co-wrote with Chris Sebela, who does High Crimes for Monkey Brain. Mm-hmm. And Scott Kowalczyk is illustrating that book. Mm-hmm. And I think that, yeah, that's everything, right? So
wow. So you're a busy guy.
Yeah, I keep busy. I've got some other stuff kind of in the works, but it's a little too soon to talk about that as well.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. If you can't talk about it, that means it's in the works and could happen. So that's, I like to hear that.
Yeah.
So that's very good. Well, now, the just so people, have, in case they want to catch up on paper, the first trade of Edison Rex comes out when?
Well, the first trade is already out.
It's
available on Amazon.com, or you can order it through your retailer. IDW is the publisher. And then the second trade comes out in the spring. So the solicits for the second trade, I think, will be at some point in December.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, once a month or so, the Edison Rex 99-cent versions, the issues will be coming out. And I like the fact that Monkey Brain Comics sends out release information on Wednesday. You'll get an email telling you what's coming out from Monkey Brain Comics every week. So if you want to keep up with Edison Rex, subscribe to that so you can get that. And there's a lot of other good things, too, that are being done by Monkey Brain Comics as well.
Yeah, they've got a ton of great comics. So
it's wonderful
definitely
stuff.
Something for everyone.
Yep. And 99 cents, how can you go wrong?
Yeah, exactly.
Just terrific. Well, I wish you a lot of luck, both you and Chris, going forward, Dennis. And I hope that Edison Rex comes around for a long, long time, because I'm enjoying the run of this book. I really think it's terrific.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Wayne.
And that concludes this special episode. There won't be a Wayne's Comics next week because of the Thanksgiving holiday, but we'll be back the next week with plenty of news, reviews, interviews, and previews. So until then, keep reading your comics.